It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Russia's assault on Ukraine expanded into a full-scale invasion overnight. President Biden announced new sanctions against Russia in a speech this afternoon. We'll talk to a Wisconsin expert about the latest in Ukraine and how the U.S. and allies are responding. First, sea levels are going up as a result of climate change. And a new report from the federal government says sea levels could rise an entire foot in the next 30 years. That could mean more and more flooding for communities along the coast, putting infrastructure like sewage systems and ports at risk, as well as houses, businesses, and roadways. We're taking a closer look at the latest data on sea level rise and what action we can take to prevent the worst of it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you concerned about these rising sea levels? Do you worry about an increased risk of flooding because of climate change? Where do you see climate change impacting your life now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Michael Mann is a distinguished professor of atmospheric science at Penn State University. He's the author of the book, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Michael, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
We have this new report from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration looking at the future of sea level rise. What are we seeing in this report?
Yeah, so the report is sort of communicating, you know, the science that's already known, and that science has been advancing quite a bit over the past several years, but not just the science, what the impacts are, what this is going to mean to us. And in that regard, it's a very important report. Among other things, it tells us, look, first of all, there is inertia in the climate system when it comes to the heating of the oceans and the melting of ice and the rising of sea level. So there's a certain amount of sea level rise that's already locked in. And we're probably looking at another foot of sea level rise by the middle of this century, no matter what we do. So we're going to have to adapt to that. We're going to have to contend with that. We're going to need to increase our resilience in the face of those impacts we can no longer avoid, while doing everything we can to prevent those impacts we still can. A foot is baked in, but whether we reduce carbon emissions dramatically over the next decade or just continue with business as usual, burning of fossil fuels, is going to mean the difference between whether we get a couple foot by the end of this century or we're starting to talk about meters of sea level rise. So our efforts today will have a huge impact down the road, but we have to face the fact that we are going to deal with the impacts of additional sea level rise no matter what we do, and we need the tools and the funding and the organization to make sure we reduce the vulnerability, especially among those who have the least adaptive capacity, the least resources.
People might hear 1 foot, 30 years. That doesn't sound like that much. What does that translate, though, into impact on coastal areas?
Yeah, so here's a fact for you. Sea level rise of just a few inches can lead to the retreat of the coastline by more than 8 feet along some of the sort of coastal regions, for example, in the Mid-Atlantic, North Carolina. So they're seeing retreat of 8 feet a year right now, just because of inches of sea level rise. Imagine what happens with a foot, and then if you can, imagine what happens with 3, 4, 5 feet. And so we're already seeing massive inundation, and it's, you know, not just sea level rise. It's the fact that sea level rise is combining with more intense hurricanes that are driven by warmer oceans. And so you get bigger coastal storm surges along with that sea level rise, and they act together to give us some of these catastrophic coastal flooding events that we've seen in recent years in the Carolinas, in Texas, Louisiana coastline, and increasingly in New England as well. So, you know, just a little bit of sea level rise means a huge amount of coastal damage and threat. And a lot of sea level rise, well, that would be catastrophic.
You mentioned the idea of adaptation. We've already seen sea level rise another foot, likely now in the next 30-ish years. What does adaptation look like? Does it mean moving away from the coast, or can we do things to mitigate and still keep all those people in those places you just mentioned living there?
Yeah, well, you know, that's that last line of retreat of our defense, which is retreat, managed retreat. And we want to minimize that, right? And so the greater the action we take, the more we slow that down. So if we do have to migrate away from our coastlines, at least we're doing so over many decades rather than over a matter of years. And so once again, action, climate action will buy us time to adapt, to adjust to these new conditions. But, you know, we're already seeing the impacts in higher insurance costs. It's more and more difficult for you to get your home insured if you're on the Carolina coastline or the Miami, you know, Southern Florida coastline. And so, as I, you know, have argued before, uninsurability is sort of the first step in uninhabitability. If you can't insure your home, then it's not a good investment, and you're forced again to move away. And those with the most resources, those with a lot of money, can do that. They can relocate. They have the resources to do that. Who's really going to be hurt are poor folks, especially this falls along, you know, we see a disproportionate impact on minority populations in flood zones that are going to be stuck with the worst impacts of climate change. And so this becomes not just a climate change problem, but a climate, you know, a justice problem.
Talking to Michael Mann from Penn State University, climate researcher, author of the book, The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet, looking at a new national report on sea level rise, another foot coming in the next 30 years or so because of climate change. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Karen is with us in Madison. Karen, hi.
Hi. I was very disheartened when I heard your question, you know, how does climate change affect us now? Because I thought it's so obvious. It's been obvious, and we've gone from climate denying to now climate adjusting in a matter of months, weeks, whatever. The quality and the fabric of our life is at risk, and as the young woman whom I cannot remember her name said, I want you to act as if the house is on fire because it is on fire. The manatees in Florida coast, they're dying because there's no seagrass to eat, and the water's polluted, and the barrier reefs are being destroyed, and we have fires in Australia, and their places are becoming deserts, and people are starving, and there's migrating because of loss of the ability to feed or even provide water for families, and there's...
Karen, I'll jump in. Thank you for calling in. And Greta Thunberg, I believe, is who you're referring to there. Michael Mann, Karen is saying the climate change impacts are already here.
Absolutely. And, you know, we've just been talking about sea level rise and the devastating impact that sea level rise is already having on people along the Gulf Coast, along the East Coast of the United States. But, you know, that all of that impacts us, you know, whether we live along the coast or whether you're in the Midwest, whether you're in Wisconsin, where we're seeing this sort of whiplash between more devastating drought and heat in the summer and these Arctic blasts, these so-called polar vortex events, which we think may be related to climate change themselves. And so it doesn't matter where you are today. What the science tells us now is whether you're on the coast, whether you're inland, you know, this is a globally connected world. When a large number of us are hurt, we all hurt. We see, you know, an impact on supply chains, on prices around the world. When one region suffers the consequences of devastating weather events. And so the climate crisis is here. It's not 10 years from now. It's not 20 years from now. It's not 50 years from now, as the caller says. It's here now. We can prevent the worst impacts if we act dramatically, and we need to do that. We need to get off our reliance on fossil fuels. The catastrophe that's playing out in global politics right now, the war in Europe, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. At the center of that is the fossil fuel economy. And so we have to recognize all of these damaging impacts that our reliance on dirty fossil fuels is having, whether it's, you know, the geopolitical problems that we're facing right now, or the climate impacts that we're already, the devastating climate impacts we're already dealing with.
Karen, thanks for the call. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, gentlemen. I have two thoughts. I believe that, you know, the worst indeed might be coming, but I think there's two possible solutions. If we reduce our population worldwide significantly, you know, radically, if we reduce the number of people on the planet, and also if we instituted a recycling program, not only nationally, but worldwide, where we reused our resources instead of kept fighting over the limited ones we have left. What do you think?
Jeff, thanks for the call. Michael Mann, population, lower population, more recycling of resources.
Yeah, thanks for the question, or both comments and questions. It is true that the more people there are on Earth using more resources, when we are, you know, living in a carbon-based, you know, dependent world, a carbon energy dependent world, that's going to mean more carbon pollution. That's going to mean more warming, more climate change. That having been said, there are orders of magnitude, 100 or more difference between how much carbon we pollute in the industrial world, in the United States, other industrial regions, and say people in some of the poor locations of the global south, in India, in Africa, where, you know, the carbon footprint is, you know, a factor of 10 or 100 smaller than that of us here in the industrial world. So we have to recognize that, you know, while population comes into it right now, the real problem isn't so much when it comes to climate change, how many people there are on this planet right now, is how many people who are living carbon intensive lifestyles. And we certainly need to do something about that. Now, the other question.
Well, I just want to jump in, Michael. Obviously, lowering population, the timescale you're talking about for climate change, lowering population, barring a horrific catastrophe that we don't want, obviously, that's a long-term thought compared to the shorter term of climate change.
That's right. And in the long term, look, we do have to figure out how to live sustainably on this planet. And there's some larger, you know, there's a larger conversation we need to have about how we move away from an expanding extraction-based civilization to a more sustainable one. And it's important for us to continue to have that conversation. But as you allude to, we've got to tackle this problem now. We don't have 10, 20, 30 years. We've got to bring our carbon emissions down by 50% by the end of this decade to avert the worst impacts of climate change, a catastrophic warming of more than 3 degrees Fahrenheit of the planet. And so that requires immediate action to decarbonize our economy. We know what the source of the problem is. It's burning fossil fuels. We have the solution in the form of clean energy. We just need the political will to massively scale up renewable energy, get off the burning of fossil fuels.
We're talking to Michael Mann, director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's with us today to talk about a new federal report showing sea levels could rise by another foot by the year 2050. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing the impact of climate change around you, wherever you live? What does it look like? How is it impacting your life? What questions do you have for our guest about this latest report on sea level rise and the other impacts of climate change? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about climate change and the prospect that sea levels could rise a foot, another foot, over the next 30 years. That's in a new NOAA report. Michael Mann with Penn State University stays with us. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Bill is with us now in Boyceville. Bill, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Bill?
So I wanted to bring up our diets as far as the impact on the climate. Animal-based meat consumption and the production of meat produces a lot of methane gases, which are
You're breaking up, Bill, but I think we got your point there. Michael, you mentioned fossil fuel burning, the main cause of climate change emissions. Bill's wondering about the impact of a meat-based diet and agricultural system.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Bill. It's an important one. And yeah, you know, fossil fuels, the burning of fossil fuels for transportation, for electricity generation, that's about 60% of our total carbon emissions. Actually closer to 66%, almost two-thirds. And so that's the lion's share of our carbon pollution, but that still leaves, you know, a third. And so we do have to look at all of the sectors of our civilization today, and agriculture and land use is an important part of that. And so, you know, in my book, In the New Climate War, I do warn about sort of shifting attention entirely to individual behavior. Polluters have been trying to do that for decades. They want to make it about our individual carbon footprint so that we're not talking about theirs. 70% of our carbon emissions comes from just 100 polluters. So yes, we should do those things that we can do in our everyday lives that, you know, that reduce our carbon emissions. They make us feel better. They save us money often. They, you know, they make us healthier when we bike, or take other means, walk, to work or school, rather than relying on fossil fuel based transportation. There's so many things that we can do to decrease our carbon footprint, and changing our diet is definitely one of them. But we're not going to see the carbon emissions reductions we need without policies, without systemic change. And we need to put pressure on our politicians, on our policymakers, to support those systemic changes that move everybody in the right direction. There, you know, there should be an incentive. We shouldn't have to shame each other if we choose to eat meat. We should have incentives that actually encourage people to get off meat, to a carbon friendlier diet. And I've done that in my own life. I don't eat meat. I feel good about my choices. I feel better. But I try not to shame others who haven't made that same decision. I try to encourage them by setting a good example.
Thanks for the call, Bill. And Michael, you're touching on the idea that this isn't just a scientific problem. We got the science down pretty much on this, but a political will problem, given the difficulties of getting people to agree within one country to take action, much less among a whole bunch of countries around the world. Do you see this as a surmountable political problem?
Yeah, I do, and I'll tell you why. About 6 years or so ago, we were moving in the right direction. The United States, under the Obama administration, had taken a real leadership role on climate. And that brought other world leaders along, other countries along, even China, that has been somewhat intransigent. They haven't had the luxury of two centuries of access to cheap energy like we have had in the West. They're still trying to grow their economy, and it's cheap to do that with the dirty fossil fuel energy. So we need to make sure that there are incentives for the developing world to not make the same mistake that we in the Western world made for two centuries. And when we did take leadership, we saw China come to the table. They were decommissioning their coal-fired power plants. They were going beyond the commitment that they had made at the Paris Agreement and to the Obama administration. Then, unfortunately, we had an administration that completely went back on our commitments, that unilaterally pulled out of the Paris Accord, the only country in the world to do that. And that said, sent a signal to the rest of the world that we weren't serious. And if the world's largest legacy polluter, we've put more carbon pollution into the atmosphere than any other country, if we're not serious about it, why should they? The good news, the Biden administration is taking a very proactive stance on climate. It is bringing other world leaders along. We are seeing China now come to the table. We're seeing India, a developing country, come to the table. And so there's reason to believe that we're starting to make the progress that we need. We're seeing carbon emissions plateau. That's the good news. They're no longer increasing year after year, in part because we're moving towards renewable energy. We're not doing it fast enough. We need to come down that mountain, halfway down, reduce our carbon emissions by 50% this decade to remain on a path that keeps warming below truly catastrophic levels of 3 degrees Fahrenheit.
Do you see low-hanging fruit? We had one caller talk about a meat-based diet. I've heard talk about, methane leaks. A caller we won't have time for, wondering about focusing on reduced vehicle emissions in the short run. What, to you, would be actions we would take that would make the biggest difference if we took them now?
Yeah, absolutely. And there are individual actions, like we've already said, that we can take to try to minimize our own carbon footprint. Not everybody is going to do that because they care about the environment or they care about the climate. That's why we need those incentives, those market incentives, so that people make the right decisions. They make climate-friendly decisions without even thinking about it, because the market mechanisms are pushing them in that direction. We're providing subsidies for renewable energy. We're pricing carbon. We're putting our thumb on the right side of the scale to help save the planet from climate catastrophe. So there are all those things we can do, but also at the systemic level, there are government programs that we need to support that help people transition to renewable energy, solar, you know, panel tax credits, other programs that encourage people to elect renewable energy and energy efficiency, as the question alludes to. Part of the solution here is being more efficient. That's how California has brought their carbon emissions down while growing their economy over the last decade or so, by reducing carbon emissions, by also putting in place efficiency measures that save energy.
In just our last minute, Michael, we're far from coasts here in Wisconsin. In a place like Wisconsin, just briefly, what would be your biggest climate change worry?
Yeah, you know, there's a very important agricultural sector in Wisconsin. I've spent some time there, dairy, crops, corn. All of that is being hurt. It isn't a future problem. It isn't 20 years or 30 years down the road. We're seeing extremely damaging impacts on agriculture in the Midwest already. And so, you know, for a state like Wisconsin, that's going to be deeply problematic. And the more warming we get, the worse those droughts and those heat waves get, the more trouble we have with, you know, in the agricultural sector, in the dairy sector.
Michael, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That's Michael Mann, distinguished professor and director of the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's also the author of The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. With us today to talk about a new federal report that says sea levels are likely to rise another foot in the next 30 years. Coming up after the news, a Wisconsin expert on Eastern Europe joins us to talk about Russia's invasion of Ukraine and how the U.S. and other countries are responding. You can join in with your reactions and your questions. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we answer an audience member's question through our Wisconsin project about farms in Wisconsin that go under, the toll that takes on families, and who actually profits in that situation. Now, Russia is attacking Ukraine in a full-scale invasion that U.S. officials had warned about in recent weeks. This afternoon, President Biden denounced Putin's actions and promised crushing sanctions against the Russian economy.
This aggression cannot go unanswered. If it did, the consequences for America would be much worse. America stands up to bullies. We stand up for freedom. This is who we are.
Biden repeated that the countries of NATO are unified in their response to Russia and that the U.S. is prepared to defend its NATO allies if Russian attacks spread further. We're catching up on all the latest developments coming out of Ukraine and what could happen next. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about Russia's attack on Ukraine? How concerned are you about what you're seeing? What do you think about President Biden's response? What role, if any, should the U.S. be playing here? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Lowell Barrington is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. Lowell, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob.
Lowell, the White House has been predicting, U.S. intelligence has been predicting that Putin would trigger this full-scale invasion of Ukraine for some weeks now, despite denials from Russian leaders. Here it is. It's happened. It looks like the intelligence was right, despite Putin's denials all along.
It does. And I think even the Ukrainian government had been critical of the U.S. in making the claims it was making about the inevitability of this. But it really has been every step of the way what the White House has been saying and predicting has come true.
President Biden tackled the reasons that Putin gave in a speech announcing the attack on Ukraine. Here's a listen to the president talking earlier today.
This was never about a genuine security concerns on their part. It was always about naked aggression, about Putin's desire for empire by any means necessary, by bullying Russia's neighbors through coercion and corruption, by changing borders by force, and ultimately by choosing a war without a cause.
Can you talk, Lowell, about Putin's reasons for this invasion, stated, and maybe the reality?
That's a really important question, Robin. I think we want to think a little bit about what President Biden said, which I agree with, which was there was not an immediate security threat to Russia, but also have in mind that what Putin really is thinking about here is the belief that he has, and I think it's one of those pieces of him where he really holds this deeply, that Russia has a right to a sphere of influence, a right to a buffer zone around it. And so the talk, even not to mention, you know, if there's any possible movement toward the idea that Ukraine would be a NATO member, he perceives as a security threat. I think he really believes that. But a lot of what he was saying was obviously both made up. There was no ongoing genocide of Russian speakers or ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine. A lot of the things that he was saying just didn't make sense. And his kind of long, hour-long revisionist history lesson that he tried to give people was pretty tortured in terms of just even the discussion of the relations between the two groups themselves over time. So I think he was kind of a solution looking for a problem for him in some ways, but he did, I think he does believe some of this a bit, though, more than we, I think, probably think he does.
Some of his speeches lately have, as you said, a revised history. He challenges the legitimacy of current borders based on the dissolving of the Soviet Union. Seems to hint that he doesn't like the borders drawn after the collapse of the Russian Empire at the end of World War One. With those standards, there's a pretty long list of countries that those justifications would, in Putin's mind, or at least the statements, give him the right to occupy. Is there a legitimate concern here that Ukraine wouldn't be the last on the list?
So that's an interesting question about thinking about the rest of the former Soviet Union, for example. I mean, I think we could imagine if he really has in mind, and I think some people have been talking about this possibility, that he's thinking about his legacy, 30, 40 years down the road in the history books, and maybe trying to recreate the idea of early Russian czars, of kind of gathering together the Russian people. And if he is thinking that way, then there would be a concern about countries like Belarus, although he's on friendly relations at the moment with Belarus, maybe northern Kazakhstan. I don't think he's thinking beyond Ukraine, in other words, to the west, to a country like Poland, for two reasons. One is Poland's a NATO member, and if he were to really move forward with a move against a country like Poland, we're now at a very, very different place, both because NATO would be obligated to respond, but also it just means at that point he's kind of lost it. I mean, he's crazy to take that kind of step. But the other reason is I think there's a part of him, again, that may believe this idea that he's saying that Russians and Ukrainians are sort of one people. He would not think that way about Russians and Poles. So, again, I would not be as worried about him moving through Ukraine and into NATO territory as I might be that he may try to push into some neighboring territories in other parts of the former Soviet Union.
Do Ukrainians right now think that Ukrainians and Russians are one people from what you've seen from the response to the invasion?
Well, it's interesting because that's been a really interesting question for a long time now. A lot of my work and work of a number of really good scholars of Ukraine has been looking at mass attitudes over time and using survey data, that we have some really good survey data out of Ukraine. And one of the things we've seen is that really since the end of the Soviet period, there's been kind of a weakening of that sense of the closeness between Russia and Ukraine. But the really big change there happened after 2014, where you had a real significant shift in mass attitudes there among not only just ethnic Ukrainians, but even some of the ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine that had a much weaker sense of attachment to Russia as a country than they did before. And so I think one of the concerns we also might have about this is Putin, because there's a part of him, at least, that may believe this idea of them being one people. I think he may also believe that Russian troops are going to be kind of welcomed in Ukraine. And I think he is very off the mark if that's what he thinks.
Talking to Lowell Barrington from Marquette University, looking at the Russian invasion of Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Lowell, we're seeing reports from reporters in Russia now showing protests. It's unclear how big or the scale of them against the war within Russia itself. What are you watching for in the reaction of the Russian people here?
Well, it was interesting because the Russian government clearly saw some of this starting to happen or was anticipating it, because they made a very public statement about not turning out in the streets to protest the conflict in Ukraine and Russian action, really as a kind of preemptive step to warn people. They also, as they often do, were trying to kind of round up people in advance that they think might be organizers of this. So clearly Putin was nervous about this, and I think right now, again, there's been somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 people already arrested today in some of these protests. So the Russian government is taking that seriously, and it wants to certainly not let those build and spread over the next few days.
I've seen, and again, this is some individual reporters talking to individual protesters who they thought, the reporters thought the protesters seemed shocked and surprised that maybe they thought this was a bluff, as some in the West did, and were surprised that the invasion actually happened. Do you think that is likely to be a widespread opinion?
It's hard to say. I think the word that I would use that I got a better sense of from people there is confusion. That even Putin's own logic, right? So even if we want to believe that he really believes this idea, which again, he may a bit, that they're one people, then why are we attacking them? I mean, I think that there's that sense in Russia of just not quite understanding this idea that if this is an extension of Russia, why are we actually using military force in this way? So I think there's some, I would say, confusion more than shock from what I've heard. But again, I think neither of those are great for Putin. And they point to an indication that he just didn't do a very good job of justifying this even to his own people.
Let's go to our callers now. Patrick is with us in Viroqua. Patrick, hi.
Hey, good afternoon and good program. How much harder does it make Washington to get everybody to line up behind them to oppose Russia on this invasion when Washington's own conduct, as far as these wars of choice, Afghanistan and Iraq come to mind, how much harder does that make Washington's job in a position of leadership here with their own past conduct and wars of choice? And thank you.
Patrick, thanks for calling in and the kind words. And Lowell, Putin had mentioned that, pointed toward those American wars of choice as part of his buildup to his justification for attacking Ukraine.
I think that it is fair. I think it's a good topic for us to debate and think back about whether, in hindsight, we had rushed into some conflicts like that, whether we fully complied with steps that we should have taken to make those decisions and got all the evidence we needed and things like that. That doesn't change the conflict here. This doesn't change that what we're looking at is a violation of international law, and it's a conflict without a real legitimate justification. I would add one thing, though, to what Patrick said, which I think what we all need to be surprised by is just how unified Europe has been. And I think Putin is really surprised by that, if I had to guess. I think he thought that he could divide European countries against each other and against the U.S. with this buildup, and that didn't happen. And I think we have seen an even greater kind of unification of the European and American response as we were going through today.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Marquette University political science professor Lowell Barrington about Russia going to war in Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you hear President Biden's address this afternoon? Do you think the sanctions he announced will be enough? We'll get into those sanctions in a minute. Are you confident in the unity of U.S. and NATO allies here? Are you worried about what's going to happen next? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Lowell Barrington, political scientist at Marquette University, with us today to talk about Russia's attack on Ukraine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. President Biden outlined some sanctions earlier today. He said European allies aren't going to remove Russia from an international financial transferring network known as SWIFT. He said the sanction he's imposing instead is just as severe.
Specifically, with the sanctions we've imposed exceed SWIFT. The sanctions we opposed exceed anything that's ever been done. The sanctions we imposed have generated two-thirds of the world joining us. They are profound sanctions. Let's have a conversation in another month or so to see if they're working.
Lowell, before we go back to our callers, can you talk about the economic sanctions, what Biden and allies did and didn't do?
Well, they're significant. I would say I think there are some people, and I think I'd fall in that camp, that were ultimately a little surprised about the decision not to include SWIFT in these. I think that would have sent a very strong message of really isolating Russia by the international community. But the other problem with the economic sanctions, and I am generally a proponent of sanctions, certainly over military options often, and they did work in the past with Russia when oil prices were dropping. So there's a couple limitations that we have this time. One is oil prices are rising, so Russia's got some reserves on hand already and will have more as oil prices rise to maybe lessen the blow of some of these sanctions. The second thing is these are going to be limited a bit because there are, I think, perceived political costs in Europe and the U.S. If we really tried to target Russia's energy sector. That's the heart of its economy. It's the place that you could really cripple the Russian economy. But President Biden would have to be willing to go on television and tell the American people we're going to see $5 or $6 a gallon gas. And I don't think politically that we're in a place, and Europe's probably not in that place either. So with that in mind, the other piece of it is the real concern here about whether Putin is even making economic calculations. So if he is, they can have an impact. But if this is really the kind of existential security concern that he's laid it out to be, or if we think that what he really has in mind here is that Russians and Ukrainians are one people and that Ukraine is really a part of Russia, the economic sanctions are kind of way down the list of his considerations at that point. So the impact will be limited at least a bit there.
Let's go back to our callers now. Sid is with us in Milwaukee. Sid, hello.
Hey, I was... Is one of the core issues that Russia has with Ukraine is in concept that it could become a part of NATO. Is that correct?
That's at least Putin's one of his stated positions, Sid. What did you want to bring up about that?
Well, so if that's the case, how is that different from our Bay of Pigs? You know, like a bordering, you know, quote unquote enemy right next to you. I don't see how we can stand and say that they have no legitimacy in guaranteeing themselves in their own domain.
Sid, I got your point. I think Lowell. So if we would have the right to overthrow a government in our neck of the woods, which has happened, Sid's wondering why not? Why wouldn't Russia have the same right?
Well, part of the answer to that is that we're in a different world from the Cold War era. And in the post-Cold War era, there were some understandings about this, including in Europe, about things that would be acceptable and not acceptable. I think what Sid's hitting on, though, is there's a real sense among some people in Russia and certainly in the Putin and the people around him, that NATO expansion represents a genuine security threat to Russia. I think the other piece of it, and we've talked about this a little in the past, is Putin was really, a lot of his current views were shaped in the 1990s. He had a group he used to meet with in a cottage on a lake kind of talks and things, and they were really during the 1990s lamenting what they thought was Boris Yeltsin kind of ruining Russia. They were very critical of the Western influence and what they saw as Western, you know, kind of undermining of Russia. And so there's a real kind of grievance that he has about the idea that the U.S. and Western Europe have already kind of weakened Russia dramatically. And so this would be just a, you know, yet another step of taking away any kind of buffer between NATO and Russia at that point. And you mix that in with those perceptions, again, of Ukraine perhaps as legitimately belonging to Russia because of historical and identity reasons. And I think you get a real sense that even the discussion of Ukraine as a NATO member, not to mention some, you know, small steps in doing a little more than discuss that and at least taking it more seriously than it had been initially, at least on the Russian side, we're seen as a pretty significant threat.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Dan in Franksville. Dan, hello.
Yeah, I remember when they got East Germany there, the United States says, we're not going to move one inch forward towards your country. Well, for the Russians to believe that was nonsense, because the Indians in this country said every contract that they ever made, they broke. They broke the contract with Iran. To top that off, he's the president that's over there. He was put in with a coup with John McCain pumping money in. They talked about getting into our elections. Russia messed with our elections. They rigged that election over there and got that guy out. That was the elected leader. So they had a coup.
Ben, I gotcha. You've already given us a lot to work with. First of all, the status of the current leadership of Ukraine, Dan describing that as a U.S.-backed coup when the Russian-backed leader was overthrown.
I would challenge that. I think that one of the things about Zelensky was he won a dramatic and really kind of landslide election, including with most of his support being not only spread across the country, but if anything, even concentrated in the east some compared to the far west of Ukraine. And I think that, you know, what I would highlight in that question is the concern that Putin has is not just Ukraine as a NATO member, but it's also Ukraine as a democracy. And on the long list of threats that Putin sees as he looks westward, look, and I'm the first one to say there were some significant flaws and remain flaws in Ukraine's democracy. There's a lot of corruption problems and things, but it was at least forming and somewhat functioning democracy in a way that was really dangerous if you're Putin, because, again, there are cultural and historical ties between Ukrainians and Russians. And the idea that group that Putin sees as so close to Russians could be supporting and somewhat succeeding with a democracy is a real shot at his idea of what the kind of proper political system is in that part of the world.
I wanted to talk about that for a couple of minutes, Lowell, the idea of Putin attacking democracies around the world, autocratic leaders or would-be autocratic leaders lining up with him in some cases, and in Western democracies, some parts of far-right movements praising Vladimir Putin as a great, I mean, former President Donald Trump has not condemned the attack and has been praising Putin's savvy, his shrewdness and things like that. Is Putin trying to change the world, not just his neighborhood?
That's been a goal for a while. I think he has what he saw was in the 1990s, in the 2000s, and you know he was president starting in 2000. And I think he saw this Western model as something that not only wouldn't work for Russia, but as something that Russia should be challenging globally as an idea. And again, some of that goes back to his sense that the American and Western approaches were really undermining Russian greatness in the area. So yes, he's taken steps to what he would see as kind of provide an alternative model for countries and to take steps to weaken democracy. He was supportive of Russian efforts in our own elections, not even just because of wanting a certain person to win, but just sort of, you know, sowing these seeds of chaos in the election is great for him because it shows that democracy is unstable and unpredictable and dangerous and things like that to other countries that he's trying to win over in that way. So, yeah, I think this is part of the democracy piece is a part of this. I don't want to say I will not go as far as Ambassador Mike McFaul, who I really appreciate and generally always agree with, I think really made that front and center in his argument. I think that security considerations and the identity considerations might be a little bit ahead of them for me. But clearly, again, he dislikes a democratic model sitting, you know, nearby to his own country.
Time for one more caller. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Afternoon, gentlemen. I guess Putin forgot about Stalin trying to wipe out Ukraine with a famine in the mid-30s and moving in Russian people and onto their property. And he also forgot about the sweetheart deal Stalin made with Hitler to divide up Eastern Europe. And, of course, he got double-crossed. And who got slaughtered when the Nazis attacked Ukraine?
Jimmy, thanks for the call. Does that historical memory loom large here for Ukrainians, Lowell?
It does. I think that they have not forgotten the forced famine on the country during the Stalin period. And it is real. It's talked about still today. And even before all this, it was been still talked about in Ukraine. So, I think that is an issue. It's a consideration. I think there's two things that I would take from that call, though, that I really want to highlight. One is if Putin, again, believes that this is something where Russian troops will be welcomed as sort of liberating heroes, you know, breaking the fascist Western bonds or whatever he's been talking about, he is, I think, going to be sadly mistaken. And I think the problem is not going to be getting control of Ukraine in terms of airports and government buildings. They can do that in a few days. The problem is the next 10 years, and the next 10 years of that installed puppet government is going to look a lot like us in Iraq or the Soviets even in Afghanistan, and it's going to be a really, really ugly period of time.
Well, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Lowell Barrington, associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. He was with us today to help us digest all the news coming out of Ukraine as the Russian invasion continues. Tomorrow on the morning show, get an up-close look at the health of the Great Lakes, including the impact of road salt on the well-being of lake ecosystems. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Are you a fan of your local state park? Do you count on your park maybe to relieve some stress during tough times? I made a couple visits to state parks over the last couple weeks, Governor Dodge, and for the first time, Yellowstone. Even in the winter weather, they were a lot of fun. Well, here's an opportunity to get more connected to your favorite park. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources put out a call for volunteers today with a wide variety of opportunities, from attending volunteer work days to trail cleanup and maintenance and lots more. They have a new online portal where you could check out opportunities in parks around the state. You can find a link over at the Wisconsin DNR website. Just look for volunteer. You can grab an opportunity from A to Z. Well, A to Y. Amnicon Falls to Yellowstone. I don't think we have any Zs. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.